Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And there is only one man to call when there is Montreal Canadiens news. And his name is Renaud Lavoie, and he works for TVA Sports. And he's on the line right now. How's it going, Ren?
Pretty busy, but it's totally normal. And it's
Thanks
Montreal,
for taking so. Time. Thanks for
yeah,
taking
no
time
problem.
For us, pal.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure for us, for sure. So Kent Hughes, not Danny Briere, not Matthew Darche, and not Patrick Roy, and he is a francophone. Does he need to – so is he going to go by Kent Hughes? Does he need to change his name? Does he need to francify the name a little bit? Do you need – I saw you clarifying on Twitter to your followers that, yes, he is a francophone.
Yeah, you have to because you know what's special about Kent? I've known him for a long time because I'm a good friend of Vincent Le Cavalier, and he represented Vincent when he was in the NHL with the Tampa Bay Lightning, and after that for the rest of his career. But that being said, that's how I met Kent, and I've got something interesting. You know, we look at our archives at TVA, and we're trying to find some footage of Kent Hughes, and guess what? It's impossible. And I've heard that at Sportsnet, it's exactly the same thing. There's no footage of Kent Hughes, which is quite unique. It shows the way he did his business over the years. He represented a lot of clients, a lot of people in the league. But at the same time, he didn't really want to be under the light. He wanted to do his things and not being in the news. And you look at, you know, how funny life is sometimes. You have a guy right now who was always under the radar. And suddenly he's going to have a lot of people asking him questions starting tomorrow at the Bell Center for his press conference. So it's you know, a new way to do business. But at the same time, I don't believe that he's going to change a lot of things. I believe that he's going to stay under the radar and find a way to help this team because as of right now, I'm telling you that team, that franchise needs help.
Is any from either side, Ren, does this surprise you from his, you know, he's leaving a very successful business.
Yep.
You know, he's a very successful agency, as you say. He's not one of those agents that, you know, shows up on Twitter or in front of the cameras a lot, but it's a big agency and a very successful agency. Does it surprise you at all that he would step away from that and take this job? And does the Habs hiring him in any way surprise you?
I'm not surprised because of his relationship with Jeff Gorton. You know, Jeff Gorton is a little bit, you know, like that. He likes to do his business. Doesn't like to be, in front of cameras every day or in the media. He wants to do his job, and if people are happy and giving accolades, he's gonna obviously be happy too. But he has a job to do, and he wants to build a championship team. So, you know, Kent. And I know he was really close to his clients. I'm a good friend, and everybody knows it, of Chris Letang. He represented Chris and Patrice Bergeron in Boston. Patrice, when he started in the NHL, at one point was living at Kent Hughes' house with all you know, all the family. So, I mean, it's not easy because of the special bonds that you have with players. And it's bittersweet, right? You have the Montreal Canadiens calling, and this is obviously a great franchise. You were born and raised in Montreal. You went to the Montreal Forum to see the Canadiens play, and suddenly you're getting a phone call, and would you be interested to be the next GM of our franchise? I mean, it's tough to say no. But I'm pretty sure that he was not, I'm pretty sure that the Kent Hughes house yesterday in the Boston area, nobody was celebrating, not because he doesn't want a job. Obviously, he wants the job. But there's another side of that story, and he's leaving a lot of people that he was really close to. That relationship is never going to change. But if you were hired to protect players to work for them, and suddenly you're saying, you know what, I'm going to do something else here. It's not easy to leave. So I guess, in a way, it's like someone being traded to a championship team. You're playing on a team, you have a lot of good friends, and suddenly it's trading deadline, and you're traded to the Tampa Bay Lightning. Obviously, it's not easy, but at the same time, you're looking at the big picture, and you're like, wow, this is going to be fun. So I'm pretty sure that that's the way Kent is thinking about the whole situation right now.
No, yeah, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, Ren. I'm interested in the process here because, yeah, it did, from all reports that I've read, it does feel like he had to have the hard sell put upon him, as I imagine Matthew Darche or Danny Briere and exactly. Patrick Roy would not have had to have been convinced to take this job. What's your understanding of the process that took place over the weeks?
Well, you know what? Because of his relationship with Jeff Gorton, I'm pretty sure that discussion arrived pretty early when Jeff Gorton was hired as the VP of Hockey Ops of the Montreal Canadiens. So, but I don't want to talk for Ken, but I'm sure that in a way his first reaction was, I can't do that right now. But it's the Montreal Canadiens calling. It's a unique situation. You have to rebuild that franchise right now. Things are not trending in the right direction, and it's a chance of a lifetime. If he would have said no to Jeff Gorton, I'm not interested, it's probably the last time in his life that he will get a phone call from somebody in Montreal asking him to be the next Canadian GM. It's because of the relationship with Jeff Gorton that, you know, he was asked. People are saying, well, Jeff Gorton just hired his best friend. It's not true. They never had dinner together in a restaurant. They never played golf together. They have a unique relationship because they have a really good business relationship. They do respect each other, but families are not going to dinner together. So, for Kent Hughes, he knew that there was a process. A committee was created to hire the next GM, and he was part of the process. He accepted it at one point. He said, yes, I'm going to do it like every other candidate. And after that, I think things went pretty well for him. But let's say that Jeff Molson would have said to Jeff Gorton, well, I'm not sure he's our guy. Not really impressed. I think we need something else. Even if it's Jeff Gorton's decision at the end of the day, if your owner is saying to you, are you sure? I think it would have been difficult for Ken Hughes to be the GM of the Montreal Canadiens. So everybody had to be on board, and that's exactly what happened.
Ren, we started out talking about how he's a guy that's likes to be under the radar, that he's not been a guy that seeks the spotlight. He's going to be the highest ranking francophone in that organization though now, so he's going to have to going to have to be a public facing part of this job. How do you think he's going to handle that?
Well, that's an interesting question because I know that Kent wants to make sure that his French is going to be as best as possible. Obviously, he left Quebec a long time ago, more than 20 years ago. But still, I don't think there's any issues with his French. So to be every day under the gun in a way, or to talk to the press probably once a month, I don't think it's going to be a big issue for him. But at the same time, if people are expecting big quotes from Kent Hughes and a guy who's going to throw people under the bus, I don't believe that. He's more a guy who wants to find solutions, right? A guy who wants to make sure that everybody feels good about themselves. He's a player agent. And what player agents are doing is they're talking to their clients when there's some issues, and he understands. So I believe that if Kent Hughes, one of his players coming at him and asking him question about why he's not playing and what to do. I don't. Kent Hughes is not the type of guy who's going to get emotional about anything. He's going to try to help. So with the media, I expect it's going to be a little bit of the same. He's going to be, in a way, probably a teacher, a guy who's going to make sure that everybody understands what he wants to do. But I don't believe that Kent Hughes is going to one day throw anyone under the bus or answer a question like Dreisaitl did today. I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, that was interesting in Edmonton today, for sure. What is he walking into, though, Ren? I mean, we talked earlier about what the patience level might be like in Montreal. I mean, they were in a cup final a season ago. They're a last-place team right now. They're losing to the Arizona Coyotes. Carey Price is still under contract through the 25-26 season. Like, what does this fan base want? A quick turnaround? Are they understanding where they are right now and it's going to be a couple of years? Like, where are the fans at with their patience?
That's a great question. Rebuild is another, you know, is a word that I'm hearing a lot again here in Montreal. And there's a lot of people saying that they're ready for a rebuild. Well, are you a season ticket holder? Are you paying $400 for a pair of, you know, for a pair of tickets to go to the Bell Center every game? Are you paying, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to go see your team, or you're just watching on TV? And by the way, you're not going to watch because it's a rebuild. So, you know, there's a lot of question marks here, and there's the business side of the game. And obviously, there's the hockey side, the hockey ops, that is really important. You want to create a team, or have a team that's going to be good, you know, for a long period. A little bit like the Tampa Bay Lightning, the Toronto Maple Leafs, but they had to go through a lot of struggle. Thing is, I think it's easier said than done, and you have to get lucky. Braden Point was not a first round pick. Nikita Kucherov was not a first-round pick. I mean, you have to understand that, yes, the Tampa Bay Lightning is a great team, probably one of the best in the last 20 years, if you look at the big picture here. But, you know, they did a lot of great things, and they got lucky. I don't want to use the word lucky because they did so many good things that, you know, they were smart enough to be better than the rest of the league. Let's put it this way. It's easier said than done. And, you know, that's what people are dreaming of here in Montreal. Probably that's what Jeff Gorton and Kent Hughes are dreaming of, too, building a franchise like the Tampa Bay Lightning. So you need to go through painful times. But at the same time, if you look at buying or getting a ticket or a pair of tickets at the to see the Lightning 5 to 10 years ago, it was way cheaper than right now in Montreal. So, and by the way, in 4 years you need to redo your TV rights, your TV right deal. So, I mean, I understand that you want the process to be painful for a couple of years, if not more, but on the business side, it's gonna hurt too. So I don't know what's the best answer, to be honest with you. But if you want to do a real rebuild, it's going to be painful, and it's not sure it's gonna work. I'm not sure it's gonna work, I should say.
Ren, I was talking to somebody today who's a friend of Carey Price's, who talked to him right before he went into rehab, and then has talked to him in the last little while. And the report coming back about the last little while was very, very positive. You know, he said he looked great, sounded great, physically and mentally, just in a great place right now. If Carey Price returns and plays out the last part of the season and looks like himself, and how does that influence not just the fans thinking about where the franchise is, but that process that you were just talking about, the idea of, you know, the teardown, because, you know, he's you know, you could tear a lot down, but, you know, he's still going to be there as part of the foundation.
Yeah, and for me, you know, that's the most important decision for Ken Hughes and Jeff Gorton. What's next? Because you have to respect Carey Price for everything that he did for this franchise. You have to respect the man, the person, and I mean, it's not like you're going to see your fourth liner and asking him, you want to stay or you want to be traded. It's going to be a difficult decision and discussion. But let's say Carey is saying, I'm ready to move on. You have your answer. If he's saying, you know what, I really like it here and I don't want to move, probably Kent Hughes and Jeff Gorton are going to respect that and probably say, you know what, maybe we have to think about what we need to do here. Carey Price wants to win the Stanley Cup, right? And that's the only thing missing right now. So we'll see what Carey's decision will be. I don't want to talk for him, but if you look at what he did last summer when he decided to waive his no-move clause in a way to play for the Kraken, I think for me it's an indication that probably he wants to leave. But like I said, I don't want to talk for him. And there's a lot of things happens between then and now. So he's going to decide what's best for him and his family. And after that, Jeff Gorton and Ken Hughes are going to make the decision. But if he really wants to finish his career as a Montreal Canadian, it's going to be really important to see what's next. Because if you look at the USA market, there's a lot of good players available. And guess what? Kent Hughes knows a lot of and Jeff Gorton. They know a lot of people around the league, and they knows they know these players that are available pretty well. So you never know. You can have a quick turnaround. But if Carey's saying, I want to leave, probably you can do, if you want to do a rebuild, it's going to be a little easier.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the interesting times are not about to end in Montreal. Maybe just beginning. Ren, we appreciate the time as always. Thanks.
Thanks for having me. Enjoy the rest of the week.
You too. See you, Ren. Renaud Lavoie, TVA Sports. It's a good point that Carey Price has already waived his no movement clause. I think, given their druthers, if you know, you took out the other factors, that both the player Carey Price and the Montreal Canadiens would be more than happy to move on from each other. It's not that simple though. When you're making over $10 million again through the 25-26 season, I can't see it. And the Canadiens aren't just going to eat money to watch him go away. If they could eat. If they didn't have to eat it, of course they'd let him go away. But yeah, we live in a salary cap world. There's just, it's hard to see a divorce between the two.
Yeah, like he waived his no movement clause in theory to go to an expansion team that had lots of, you know, room cap wise, and it was also right next door to where he lives, you know, where he grew up on the West Coast. So there might have been there are some other factors there. But I think that's the whole thing, Ben. Like, it's one thing to say, well, yeah, let's find an opportunity where he can maybe try and win a Stanley Cup. Obviously, that wasn't going to be with the Kraken. Yeah, you know, in a way that you can kind of restart and maybe restock the Montreal Canadiens. But I don't see how you do that with this contract. I just do not see that. And remember, we are, that cap number's going to stay pretty flat for a while, thanks to what's been going on this year.
But we will see. Raptors come close, but fall to the Miami Heat yesterday. It doesn't matter, though. They go into the midway point of the season above 500. Let's talk to Brian Windhorst of ESPN. Brian, thanks so much for doing this. So, yeah, we're less than a month away from the trade deadline, and the Raptors are above 500. Can we say for relative certain that the Raptors will be buyers by the time the deadline rolls along?
Boy, that's really up in the air. You know, I don't know if anybody knows. I'm not sure if they've made up their mind. I mean, you know, they're very close to the luxury tax. That's a factor. You know, does ownership give them the clearance to go into the tax if they're going to be a play-in team? You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. You know, they have the Dragic contract. So when you have something like that, you have, you know, fodder in a trade. You know, they have the requisite thing that you need to make a move, and they're playing better. And the thing about it is, you know, Nick Nurse has continued to demonstrate that he will get the most he can out of this team. And so when you have Siakam working so hard to get back, you have Van Vliet working so hard on this season. You're instilling a work ethic in the players that you're a no excuse team. I think that's something that maybe Nick Nurse has done as good as anybody in the league. Maybe Eric Spoelstra right there with him. All of the hand that is dealt the Raptors just deal with it. They don't always win, but they just deal with it. And so you are asking so much of your players to do that. Sometimes, you know, if you're the front office, you feel like you have to do your part in that too, even if it's a minor move. So we'll see where, the board, you know, says that you can spend. I mean, certainly finances aren't really a problem for the Raptors, but it's hard for me to look at them losing all of this revenue and say spend. I mean, it's easy for me to say, especially, you know, across all of their businesses. So I don't know where they are at that. I don't know, whether or not they could do a trade where they take back less money or they could do a trade where they take back more money. These are things that we're going to have to see as in the next 2-3 weeks we learn more about what they're talking about as the stuff leaks up.
Now, Brian, when we went into the season, I guess there was also the possibility that they might be a seller at this point of year. So that's, in your opinion, would that be out the window now? Any notion that they would be selling and kind of trying to reset and regroup to, you know, build a team that could compete for a championship?
I agree. I mean, I definitely think that people thought that Siakam could be available. I never really heard Van Vliet or OG Anunoby, but people thought that Siakam could be available. I have not heard one iota of that. And the way that they're playing, I can't see it. You know, I think a great goal for them would be, can they get into the top six? Can they get into a situation where they don't have to go into the play-in? That would be a tremendous accomplishment for this season. And really, from a macro level, everything that you're doing is really all about Barnes. Because Barnes is the future of the organization. And, you know, if you have to use an asset because you want to get Barnes into the playoffs and experience what a playoff series is like, it may be worth it. Now, I'm not saying that I would, you know, necessarily rent a player or take a player that may influence, you know, impact what he does and stuff like that. But, you know, there may be a value that you may get something for what you spend, whether it's a draft pick or it's additional money. And, you know, to me, that's a factor. You know, whenever you look at what the Raptors are doing for the foreseeable future, it revolves around Scottie Barnes. And my excitement level and their excitement level and the league's excitement level over what he can be is immense. You just don't see rookies achieve at both ends the way he's achieving, both him and Evan Mobley. And you see how it's changed the Cavs horizon. Scottie Barnes is going to change and already is changing the Raptors horizon. And so as they look at this decision, keep in mind that Barnes is sitting side saddle with all of those calls.
Yeah, he's overachieved, maybe not in the eyes of the Raptors, but for many outsiders, this team as a whole is overachieved. One of those things that they might go out and try and acquire before the deadline. I mean, you mentioned Goran Dragic, a backup point guard. Fred VanVleet is playing the most minutes in all the NBA right now, Brian, and Dragic is making almost $20 million. They got him in that sign-and-trade for Kyle Lowry. Of course, there was the deleted Instagram post about him working out in the Heat facility. I understand that he was dealt here with the understanding that perhaps he would be moved and didn't expect this team to be maybe as good as it's been. Do you have any understanding of what the relationship is like between Dragic and the Raptors? Was there at any point a request for him to report here, or do you see him playing for the Raptors before the deadline? Do you see him being moved?
Well, when the Raptors gave him permission to go back to Florida for what I believe have been told his family reason, they were basically making the decision that he was not going to be with them. Now, maybe they weren't in their minds making a season-long decision, but when you let somebody go back like that, you're eventually saying, especially in this case, you're basically saying that you've made a decision he's not going to be with you. This reminds me of kind of what Andre Iguodala, when he was with Memphis, you know, they sent him home. And when you send somebody home, it means he's probably not coming back. So I would expect that they trade him. And then if he's not traded, he would look to probably get a buyout after the deadline. It's especially since they didn't recall him when they were down to four players. If you're not going to recall him then, I don't know when you're going to recall him. Now, I just to be clear with what I'm about to say, I don't know this to be the case, okay? But typically, he would never go into another team's practice facility unless he had the Raptors' permission. You know, over the summer, for example, hundreds of NBA players spend the summer in Los Angeles, and some of them use the Clippers and Lakers facilities to practice. But those players would never go into those facilities without their team's permission. So I can't believe, I think they probably believed it because it was a bad look. I would be stunned if he went there. I just, you know, I don't think the Heat would do that. I don't think the Heat would let him in without the Raptors having given permission.
Yeah, makes sense. Brian, what would he or his contract be worth at the deadline? How much value would it have in a trade?
You know, it's right now, there's just not many sellers out there. There's a couple of teams that are sitting on the fence. So as an example, Portland is one of the teams that's sitting on the fence. You know, there's some people who believe San Antonio may be sitting on the fence, where they're going to actually go ahead and trade away talent. But for the most part, and I think this is a reality with the new play-in tournament where there's now 20 teams that are going to make the postseason and maybe 23 to 25 who think they still can in February. I just think we're going to see a more depressed trade deadline because more teams think that they're in it. And so I am seeing way more teams that want to buy than teams that want to sell right now. So, I mean, I could throw some things out there, but I really think we're going to have to wait. I think that we'll see the trades happen really close to the deadline because some teams are going to have there's going to be some teams out there that are fringe players that have a bad next 3 weeks. And there could be some injury. Like, you know, for example, you know, Paul George, he might be out for the year. We're waiting to find that out. And if he's out for the year, it may completely change the way the Clippers look at the way they're going to approach the trade deadline. And so there could be other things that happen. You know, for example, we're waiting for word about Zion Williamson, whether Zion Williamson is going to be able to come play. The Pelicans are a team that's in 12th place right now. So you would say, well, that's a team that should be selling. But what if the Clippers in front of them all of a sudden are not going to have Paul George or Kawhi, and they're going to find out that they're going to be able to get Zion back? That's going to change the complete way they operate. So some of this is just conversations right now as we wait to see how this gets clarified.
Well, one of the names that Raptors fans have you know, really bandied about in their minds the last couple of days is Miles Turner, and the Pacers will be one of those teams that is selling in February. I know he has the injury, and they're going to reevaluate him, I think, in a couple of weeks. It's a foot injury. He fits a need for this Raptors team. Have you heard anything in regards to the Raptors' interest in Miles Turner?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously there was the rumor about OG and Anobi. I had not heard that. You know, here's the reality when you have a player like Miles Turner. When you formulate, if you're a fan and you're formulating the trade that you're going to offer, and you go to the trade machine and you get it and you say, why don't they do this deal? You have to realize the other teams get to bid. You know, if a team is going to trade a player, they're going to take bids from everybody else. And so in the case of Miles Turner, you know, there's four or five teams that are really interested, although he's now got a stress reaction, and that's not what you want to hear on a seven-footer. So considering the players that I know that the Raptors really like, I would be surprised if they were going to be able to outbid some of these other teams. But, you know, I'm saying that more out of my viewpoint than anything anybody's told me. The other thing is, from what I understand, Indiana has prioritized draft compensation for Miles Turner. I don't know if the Raptors are in the mood to send out draft compensation for a player like that, especially a player like that who's instantaneously going to want a contract extension.
Hey, Brian, we really appreciate you joining us today. Thanks so much for this.
Enjoy your day, guys.
There's Brian Windhorst of ESPN. And, yeah, Raptors are in a good spot right now, and they're in a playoff spot right now, or at least in a position to play in a play-in game. But and I expect them to add, maybe incrementally, but it's hard to imagine a team in this phase of its development giving away, well, not giving away, but trading away first-round picks and futures for something that's not going to put them over the top. And as good as Miles Turner is and as much as he fills a need, he's not turning this Raptors team into a championship contender.
No, plus, you know, even injury aside, there's going to be, as Brian alluded to, there are other suitors there, right? He's a valuable commodity, and it's yes in a vacuum, but you know, in a competitive marketplace, it's hard to imagine that it would make sense for them to make a move like that, and you know, then you have to start contemplating what the actual price would be.
Yeah, we will see if it's OG Anunoby. That probably gets it done if the Raptors are willing to part with him. We'll see, though. When we come back, we mentioned yesterday that the international signing window was open. The Blue Jays signed 18 international free agents already in the first couple of days since it opened. They've had good success in the international window. Vlad Jr., Gabriel Moreno, Aurelvis Martinez. Hey, Alejandro Kirk as well. We'll talk to Keith Law about that process and perhaps Mr. Moreno's chances of breaking camp with the Blue Jays if and when the season ever gets underway. Keith Law of The Athletic joins us next as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And it may not seem like a pressing issue to you when it comes to Major League Baseball CBA negotiations, but you know what? The idea of this international draft, Stephen, might be really important to the Toronto Blue Jays, who have done very well in this international free agent market. They had the smallest amount of money to spend this season. They spend almost half of it on the catcher Mesa, but they've acquired some franchise cornerstones. I mean, one is a potential MVP. I mean, he finished second this year in Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but Gabriel Moreno acquired that way. Aurelvis Martinez, same thing. Alejandro Kirk. These are success stories already. I mean, Moreno and Martinez, I guess we'll see, but Kirk was not expected to reach the majors at the rate or the pace that he did. And if you do it the same way that the June amateur draft works, where it's a, you know, reverse standings things, if the Blue Jays are as competitive as we expect them to be in the coming years, could really lose out on something.
Yeah, no, it's a place where you can improve your team even while you're good, you know, when you're not drafting in the top 10. It's a place where you can still out-hustle other teams. You can, you know, find players that other teams don't know exist, or you can decide to allocate your resources and pay a guy more than other people will. It's a really interesting market in a lot of ways. We'll ask Keith about this when we have him on, but just how an international draft would change the entire structure of baseball, right? It's kind of hard to imagine, right, just off the top of my head, how it would work.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it's definitely one we will ask our next guest, who is on the line right now, Keith Law of The Athletic and former Blue Jays assistant to the general manager. Keith, thanks for doing this. Yeah, I just rattled off a couple of the names that Blue Jays fans are aware of that were acquired through this international signing window, and Vlad Jr. and, of course, Gabriel Moreno among them. Do the Blue Jays have one of the best reputations when it comes to the international market?
It comes and goes, and it really depends on it. It's tied very much to your annual classes, right? Teams might have one year where they do particularly well, and Mariners had one year where they got Julio Rodriguez and Noel V. Marte, both of whom are among the top 20 prospects or so in all of baseball right now. So for a moment it was, well, the Mariners do really well out there. There are some teams that are that have consistently ignored this market. The Orioles have been absent from this market for a long time. Same with the Angels for a while. But most teams realize you can't build a good farm system without being pretty involved in international free agency, and they tend to sort of go in waves of their years where they're more active, years where they're less active, and it may be tied to money or tied to what commitments they remember. You commit to these guys 3-4 years out when they're 13 or even 12 years old. So sometimes you think you have the right guys, and then, hey, this kid grew 6 inches and this kid didn't. And suddenly what you thought was a good decision turns out not to be one because nature had other ideas.
Yeah, So there are elements out of your control for sure. I've been in the Dominican for a variety of stories over the years, Keith, and seen some of, especially the growth and some of the complexes the teams have put up down there. You know, they used to be pretty bare bones back in the day. Now some of them are like, you know, spring training complexes, right? And they have schools where they work on language skills with guys. There's all kinds of, they put a ton of money in some organizations more than others. But I wonder, you know, is that, like, what kind of dictates success? We think of the old kind of dollar sign on the muscle scouts or the dealing with the Buscones down there, or all the stuff that you do down in the Dominican. But what makes an organization successful in a place like the Dominican?
Well, you nailed a lot of it. I mean, some of it is just the scouts you have, the quality of your evaluations. And then a lot of it is the quality of the player development that you can offer once you get them into the system too. So typically guys will sign at 16 and maybe play their first actual games at 17 in the Dominican Summer League. There isn't really a Venezuelan Summer League anymore. I do hope at some point we'll see, maybe it's Venezuela, maybe it's Colombia, it's somewhere else, just more places for these kids to play. It's more games is just always good. But now we don't have the short season leagues in North America anymore. So teams are really faced with a bigger developmental challenge. You bring those kids over maybe at 18 or 19 to play in for the Jays, it'd be the Gulf Coast League, whatever we're calling it, the Florida Man League now. And then you have a huge decision to make of, well, do we repeat them there? Do we send them to full season ball? It's another evaluation that you have to make. So you're first evaluating these kids when you first sign them, and then making another really significant evaluation when they're 17 or 18, trying to decide how to further their development without hurting them by pushing them too far. And if we just look at some of these guys that the Blue Jays have gotten into the system the last few years, one, I think they've made very good decisions in player development. They've also signed a lot of these international position player free agents who are pretty advanced at the plate, who just have better command of the strike zone than the typical player out of, you know, if you just look at the average of all players signed out of Latin America. This just seems to be something they're doing well right now. And I think it's a big part of the reason why the Blue Jays are today, like, I would say that they get a very large percentage of the quality, the talent in their farm system is from international. And why I think that if you look at my list is now, yep, when my ranking of the best Blue Jays prospects comes out, there's a lot of international signees on it because a lot of those guys have come over to the U.S. and shown that they can make some of those jumps, that they fared well with the challenges that player development has given them.
You know, the other thing that struck me down there, Keith, and again, in terms of the scouting and trying to evaluate, as you say, you know, 14-year-olds or 13-year-olds, especially, again, I'm talking about the Dominican, but there's a lot of unorganized baseball, you know, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of guys working out in parks, but you know, in North America, it would be, you know, they'd be progressing through, you know, little league baseball, through high school baseball. If it's college guys in college baseball, like against like, you know, it's pretty easy to evaluate. But like down there, when you're watching a bunch of guys take ground balls in a, you know, on a sand lot almost, like how do you evaluate? It's got to be a different set of skills, right? Trying to figure out what a guy is without, you know, you know, necessarily seeing him compete in actual baseball games.
So what you're talking about is true. They do see players in these sort of unorganized, less organized venues. And at that point, you're really just trying to evaluate body type and projection, athleticism, actions, you know, how quick are his hands? How does his swing work? You know, does he have bat control? If he's a pitcher, can he control his body? Does he have coordination to his delivery? Because these kids aren't going to look the same physically when they turn 16, and the way they play is probably going to change over that time too. You get stronger. I mean, most of us have experience playing or watching kids play at those ages. You know, a 13-year-old is probably not that coordinated compared to what he'll look like when he's 16, 17, or 18. So when you're just evaluating kids like you're describing, you're not even really worried about how they're playing, right? It's not about the competition. Now, the better kids who get, they work with Busconis or other trainers down there, they will do showcases essentially. And so they're not games, but you at least will get to see, say, a hitter facing a real pitcher, facing real stuff, real velocity at least. And then you can see what his swing looks like when he's facing a decent fastball, which you're not going to see in these, just for lack of a better word, these sort of sandlot looks. They're two separate things. And generally when I talk to teams about those players that they've signed, they lean much more on what they saw in those, still somewhat contrived, but those showcase type setups.
Hey, Keith, I got to be honest. When I hear about, 12 and 13-year-olds being scouted and some of the processes that are involved in this international market, it feels kind of gross. And, I was thinking about this international draft from a purely baseball perspective. But, is there a moral argument to be made to changing the way things are done right now?
So, look, the way that things are done right now is incredibly exploitative. I mean, unbelievably exploitative. However, an international draft kids won't be scouted and signed at 12 or 13. Right? They'll be drafted at 16. Unfortunately, what it's going to do is have less money flowing to the players. So I don't like the current system. I think that there's a lot wrong with it. It's also a little creepy. But there's a lot of money flowing to players. Now, that's less than there was before the most recent CBA, the one that just expired. And I'm afraid the new CBA will probably just cut the money even further. To the players, of all players who enter the ecosystem of baseball, these are generally the kids who come from the least. And so there's something really immoral about saying, yeah, we're going to give even less money now. These hundreds of Dominican and Venezuelan and Panamanian free agents who are signing, yeah, we're going to send even less money to them, even as they seem to be occupying more and more of the significant roles in Major League Baseball. We get a lot of our stars from Latin America, and we generally pay them less to come into the sport, even than we play their U.S., Canadian, Puerto Rican-born counterparts, which also feels very, very wrong. And that'll only get worse if we go to an international draft.
So, Keith, who wants an international draft, and how would it change the business?
Rob Manfred wants an international draft. He said so, and most owners do as well, because it saves them money, and they don't care. They just do not care about whether they're exploiting players. And, this is a Jeff Bezos situation, right? It's billionaire owners refusing to give money to the, lowest paid workers in their industry. It would clean things up from a corruption standpoint, right? We have had plenty of issues of teams doing things. Atlanta got badly sanctioned. Their GM was banned from the sport for life for violating the rules on signing international free agents. That stuff can happen because the system is fairly unregulated and because there's no draft. If you have a draft, that stuff just goes away because it does not matter if you've had a deal with so-and-so since he was 12 and a half years old. Some other team can just walk in and say, we're drafting him, and that's that. That is the one good thing about the draft is it gets rid of all of that. I mean, it's corruption. It is absolutely corruption in baseball terms. It would go away. It is the one argument I can see for doing that. I think there are a lot of other reasons against it. I'm completely resigned to the fact we're going to have an international draft. I have no doubt in my mind, but I think it's going to be a net negative for the sport, and it's particularly negative for the players involved.
So you're saying, like many things in life, it is not black and white. Okay, I see it. The shades of gray. all right, let's talk about one of those players the Blue Jays have gotten through the current system in Gabriel Moreno, and it's not very often that you can have a team on the ascension that almost made the playoffs a season ago and have one of the best prospects in baseball that is yet to make his debut. Just straight up, Keith, is this Blue Jays team in its most effective form if Gabriel Moreno is on the opening day roster?
I don't think so. He really only played about half a season in Double A last year, maybe not even half a season. And he played well in the Arizona Fall League, so he did do what he could to make up some at-bats, but he had the thumb fracture that cost him a lot of time, and he's never played above Double A. he's not had much opportunity to catch better quality pitching. I would much rather, and I think Moreno is a stud. He's their number one prospect. He is a top 10 prospect in all of baseball. I have zero doubt he's going to remain at catcher, and he can really, really hit. But I think there's a lot to be said for letting that guy go to AAA for the start of this season, and particularly just let him catch better pitching, better stuff. Guys who, yeah, it's a lot of guys in AAA who throw extremely hard, but maybe they don't have great command. Okay, well, that's actually not bad for trying to develop a catcher. Here, go catch these guys who throw really hard, have great breaking stuff, and don't know where it's going. No, that'll prepare you pretty well for the big leagues where some of them do know where it's going.
Keith, I got to say, I think you're our first guest where we've actually heard their cat meow in the background. So congratulations.
He's not even in the room. That's the amazing thing. He is a jerk. He knows I'm on the phone, and that's it.
That's amazing.
Feed him. Yeah.
Seriously.
I can see the shadow of his paws under the bedroom door.
All right. Well, take care of that, Keith. We appreciate you taking the time for us. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks, my Keith. Pleasure.
All right. There's Keith Law, the Athletic, former Blue Jays assistant to the GM. So, yeah, you know, like, you know what? There's no easy solutions, like in life. There are no easy solutions, Stephen. But yeah, it does sound gross when you're going to the Dominican Republic and talking to some dirt poor kid at 12 years old and promising him the world and, you know, leading him on for years and years and years, and maybe he ends up with something, maybe not. That part of it just it feels gross to me, but I don't know if there's an easy solution.
Well, it is. Yeah, it is. That's not even mentioning the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other kids who are lined up behind that kid out there every day, you know, taking ground balls, hanging out with the Buscones, who are the street agents, and thinking that they're going to get a shot, and they aren't. But as a way off the island, as a way out of poverty. So, no, it is. It's grotesque in that sense. And, you know, the reason it's not like, as Keith alluded to, it's not like suddenly on international signing when they open it up that they call up the 16-year-old and say, we're going to sign you. They've had deals with these kids since they were 12 or 13 or with their agents, with these street guys who take a big chunk of that signing bonus. But, you know, the other part Keith's right about is that if you go to a, you know, the reason the owners want to go to an international draft is so they can spend less money. And so less money will flow through to the players. So however grotesque it is, more money is flowing through to players in the Dominican and Venezuela and elsewhere now than it would if there was an international draft. So, you know, where's the moral high ground here? It's a tricky one.
No, it's a very, very tricky one. And I don't know if just like a worldwide draft, why can't you just do one unified draft? Now, that messes with the age groups, right? Because I mean, you can draft a kid right out of high school, but if he goes to a junior college, he has to spend, a junior college, he only has to spend a year. But if you go to a college, you got to spend a couple of years, and you've got these kids that are 16, literally. And yeah, Vlad Jr. was one of those signed at 17. I guess the best answer would be you make the international draft, but you still give them the same amount of money. But yeah, I don't think Major League Baseball and Rob Manfred's going to go for that one.
That's not the idea. No. The idea is the opposite, that you give them way less money and you still have this enormous source of talent that is begging to play in your game that you don't have to pay for, right? These baseball factories that are, you know, if you look at the young stars in baseball, who's driving the sport, where the excitement's coming from, that's where it's coming from. That's where it's coming from. And baseball doesn't have to put a dime into it.
No, it's true. And you know what? Now the Blue Jays actually have real audio of a prospects expert saying that Gabriel Moreno does not have to break camp with that team next year. So it will not be service time manipulation if Moreno is not playing with the Blue Jays April 1st, I suppose. I still want to see it. But yeah.
All-star break.
I get the argument.
That's the over-under.
Okay. The all-star break. I'll take it. You know what? I just want to see baseball in April. Whether Gabriel Moreno is playing or not, whatever. I just want to see baseball. Please, give me some good news. All right, we'll be back tomorrow. At least I will. And you'll be back on Thursday. We'll see you then, Stephen. See ya. This has been The Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.